Les conférences du Collège de France.
Yeah, I think that's going to be sort of the message.
The main message.
The main message. But we have some prelude before coming to that. But so I guess the starting point is sort of a remark made in this classic on democracy in the United States of America from the 1800s. Then Alexis de Tocqueville said that the defining characteristic of democracy is the love for equality. So the idea was that democracy is the love of equality. But despite this remark, it's rather remarkable, as also mentioned yesterday, that we still see widespread inequality of political opportunity in many contemporary democracies. So it really seems that the center of democracy has not been able to sort of reduce the fact that if you are born into politically or economically marginalized families, you simply stand a lesser chance of growing up to become a politically influential citizen. So, as we discussed yesterday, there are many different reasons for this. Some of these are social, others seems to be more biologically related. We also saw that this kind of persistence across generations could not only involve parents, but also grandparents or great-grandparents. But since we have this kind of persistence and democracy has promised to get away with this kind of importance of family background in politics, we should also raise the question, is there anything we can do about this? Inequalities of political participation. Is there a way to break this vicious cycle of political marginalization being transmitted across generations? So a bit provocative, I might say that the question for today's lecture is, can this kind of intergenerational political inequalities that we talked about yesterday, can it be educated away? So that's the topic of today's lecture. And as always, I guess one can trace much of this discussion about democracy as a prerequisite, rather education as a prerequisite for democracy, back to the Enlightenment liberals, such as Montesquieu, Condorcet, and John Stuart Mill. But few people wrote as extensive on this topic among the Enlightenment thinkers as the American revolutionary and later the third president, Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson, among other things, he drafted this bill for a new public education system in his home state of Virginia. And in that bill, he laid out this idea about the role of education in a democracy. And according to Jefferson, he saw this dual purpose of education. First of all, he envisioned that we're going to have these primary education schools. So he had this idea, we're going to sort of have a lot of publicly funded primary schools. And the main purpose of these primary schools, that was to prepare citizens and give them these basic capabilities so they can participate in politics and wisely, as he said, elect the rulers. So he had this idea that primary education was for the masses, going to prepare them for this new role of being a citizen in the democratic regime. But Jefferson also had this idea of higher education. So he had this idea that you're going to establish these schools, and he was very keen on these schools being located close to the children in order to make education accessible, because it was difficult and often expensive to travel to school. And the purpose of these higher education, according to him, that was to train the rulers, because in a democracy, we as the people must also be the rulers. And then it was important for him to sort of enlarge the pool from which these rulers can be selected. So his idea was by doing and making education more accessible, he could also increase the pool from which we can draw these future rulers. So if you're going to borrow a term from one of his contemporaries, Horace Mann, who was also an American, we can say that what Thomas Jefferson and other Enlightenment theorists were envisioning here was education as a great equalizer. The idea was, according to Thomas Jefferson, to ensure that this ruling class are comprised of the talented and virtuous rather than the wealthy and wealth-born. So the idea was to sort of get rid of this importance of family background in terms of wealth and being well-born, and instead sort of establish what he called the natural aristocracy, that is, ruled by the most talented and virtuous. However, even though he became a president, his bill was never introduced in Virginia, but still these kind of ideas, they continue to be very important in modern political science. One example of that was 20 years ago, this American Political Association sort of had this task force who were sort of trying to look into the relationship between inequality, economic inequality in the US, and democracy, and provide different kind of sort of solutions to what they saw as a big challenge for democracy. And in this report that they wrote, this leading political scientist, they pointed to this idea, going back to Jefferson and Tocqueville and others, saying that since education is such a powerful predictor of political engagement, rising absolute levels of education might be expected to facilitate the political activation of those at the bottom of the SES social status hierarchy and produce class convergence in participation. So this is a sort of common theme in much of political science writing, saying that education is important because schools are the places where children learn these kind of participatory skills that they need in order to be good citizens and good rulers. But they also acquire these social networks. I mean, our social networks are often important. If you're surrounded by other politically active people, the chances increase that you're going to become politically active yourself. And the third thing is often pointed out, that in schools we internalize these kind of norms, that political engagement, political participation is a civic duty that we as a citizen should carry out. So the idea is that all these things can give rise to this positive relationship between one's level of education and one's level of political participation. But going back to the question that they asked, whether or not we can reduce the differences with respect to family background, or if we can achieve this kind of class convergence that this APSA task force envisioned, then I guess it's not enough that education is just increasing political participation. Because if we lift all boats the same amount, we will not have any reduction in the differences with respect to family backgrounds. In order for this to happen, there must be some kind of mechanisms that are sort of driving this kind of convergence, reducing the gap between those of low and high SES backgrounds. And last, thinking about this theoretically, envisioning different kind of educational reforms, we can see two main mechanisms. The first one is just that if we introduce a new school system or make education more accessible, we will mainly increase the educational levels of those at the bottom of the SES hierarchy. That we could call a resource effect. We give those disadvantaged children more of this resource. So we're closing the gap in the level of these resources across the distribution. So if education is equally important for all these children, then we're going to have this kind of convergence if the gap in educational levels are decreasing as a result of reform. But there's also another possibility here, that even if the educational levels are increasing by the same amount in all socioeconomic groups, we can get convergence if education is more important for those of disadvantaged social background. And that would happen if we, for instance, think about sort of the home environment and education as substitutes in the production of political participation. Then we're going to see a larger return effect among those of low SES backgrounds. We can call that the return effect. So you see there are two different possibilities here. if we sort of implement an education reform that could either reduce inequality by providing more education to those at the bottom of SES hierarchy, or it could reduce inequality by education being more important for those from low SES homes. Important to note, however, is that both this resource effect and return effect, in order for them to work, there must be a causal effect of education on political participation. So as I said yesterday, wherever we look, we know that education is very strongly correlated with education. So for a long time, we just took it for granted that, of course, since these things are so highly correlated, it must be the way that education causes individuals to be more politically active. But partly sort of a result of this big sort of this experimental revolution in economics and later political science, people were starting to question this view and saying, hey, do we really have evidence that there is a causal relationship? Trying to use these new fancy techniques, trying to run experiments or having these match samples or IV strategies, people come up with no causal effect of education on participation. And they started to argue that this correlation we see is more likely spurious than causal. The reason why education and political participation are associated is that both education and participation are caused by the same unobserved pre-adult experiences and predispositions. So in one of these articles, they even went as far as describing education as a great proxy rather than a great equalizer. So you see, if this is the end of the story, obviously, sort of this view going back to Jefferson and others will not really work. If there is no causal effect of education on political participation, there is no way that we can reduce intergenerational political inequality by more or better education. But even though this research is methodologically sophisticated, I would argue that it suffers from at least two main limitations. The first limitation I would argue is that it doesn't, to a sufficient extent, differentiate between different types of education and educational reforms. For one thing, if you just think that, as a political scientist, I would like to think that teaching civics might be more important for political participation than teaching physics. So obviously, if you're going to look at a certain education reform and see whether or not that's going to make people more politically active, it could matter what is the content of education. And often in these studies, one is just focuses on sort of the years of education, and disregarding sort of what you fill this extra time of education with. Another, and to some extent even more serious limitation, would argue, is that assume that education impacts all groups in the same way. So somewhat simplified, much of this literature implicitly assume that education is a standardized commodity that affect all individuals in the same way. But as I'm going to argue, I've also said before, if, for instance, you take this view that the home environment and education are substitutes in the production of political participation, that will not be the case. Then it could obviously be that education are more important for some individuals than other individuals. So if you just look how more education relate to participation across the average of a certain population, in the overall population, then we might miss these very important effects of education in certain subpopulations and subgroups. So as often, sort of the devil might be in the details, and continue on this thing, is also the case that the proof of the pudding is in the eating. So whether or not this is the case, we cannot decide on strictly theoretical grounds. There are theories also that education and home environment might be complements in the production of participation. And that we could, in that case, we could actually sort of increase inequality by educating people more, because then it's mainly those that are already advantaged, they're going to benefit from education. And then we can actually do worse by providing more education. So in order to see what that is, I would argue that we need to look at the data. The problem, as I said, looking at the data is not that easy in this case. The first thing is, since we have this argument that education and political participation might partly be due to the same unobserved factors, then just looking at correlation will not help us much. So if we're going to sort of make some kind of an advantage on this important issue, we need to have some kind of what you call exogenous variation in education. We simply need to have something that forcing some people to be a bit more educated than others, or at least have something that sort of introduce some difference in the access to education across the population. Another thing we need to have enough data to study this kind of heterogeneity in the treatment effects. So we need to have sufficient data to really look at different subgroups. And as you can imagine, in order to get sufficient statistical power here, we need to have large data, because otherwise these subgroups are likely going to be too small for us to really precisely estimate the effect in that group. And the third thing is, if we're going to stick to this idea that education can have different effect for different individuals, then it might also be important to see whether or not we see similar effect across different types of educational reforms. For instance, at different educational levels. It could be that increasing the length of primary schooling might have a rather different effect on political participation than sort of making higher university education more accessible. And it could also be that changing the schools in the 40s might have a different effect on participation than changing the schools in the 1990s or 2000s. So really, we need to sort of have some kind of variation there. Unfortunately, and as I said yesterday, at least we have this kind of population data in our Swedish administrative registers that at least meet one of these requirements, and that is that we have enough data to study certain subgroups. Because now we can look at the entire population, and we have these different measures of political participation. It could be whether or not people are voting, or whether or not people are running for political office or elected to political office. And since we also have these big registers, we can link them to other registers. We can look at sort of certain subgroups for certain age cohorts, those born after the 1930s. We can also link them to the parents in order to see whether or not these kind of effects play out differently depending on your parental background. But in order for this to work, you also need to have some kind of sort of exogenous variation in education. And again, one can then look to the history as some sort of toolkit for these kind of natural experiments. Sometimes we introduce these kind of reforms that fortunately buy us some exogenous variation that we can utilize for research purposes. Since we can't really sort of randomize education in the population, that would be nice. But some people might then be very frustrated, especially those not getting an education. Or some of my friends from my hometown, they might perhaps be even more disappointed if they were randomized to very long educations because they thought education was boring. But so look at the sort of history, and that's what me and my colleagues have done in our previous research they're going to sort of talk about today. We have these in Sweden, these large school reforms that were implemented during different parts of the 20th century that we argue increased schooling and also sort of created these kind of exogenous variation indications. We're going to try to utilize them in order to say something about this bigger question. That is, can we mitigate political inequality by improving educational opportunities? So we have three different studies that we try to achieve this in different ways. The oldest, or at least the one that looking at the earliest reform, is a study that looked at the opening of new junior secondary schools and how that affected the likelihood that children ran for or were elected to political office as adults. And in order to understand the background of this study, we need to understand the way Sweden was in the early 20th century. I guess it was much like many other West European countries, that education was some, especially like higher education, that was something for privileged children. It was not everything that all people could do. So really, most people just went to primary schools for 6 or 7 years. Then we had this small minority of the children who went on to higher education, and they were mostly from privileged social backgrounds. But in the 1930s, we get this social democratic government in Sweden, and had this idea that we need to do something about this. We need to sort of improve educational opportunities for individuals and children from less privileged social backgrounds. And the first thing they would like to do then was saying that, hey, the problem with the Swedish school system is like all the schools for higher education. In this case, lower secondary education was higher education. It might be a bit difficult, but since most people just went to primary school, lower secondary school was higher education. And that schools for that lower secondary schools, that were mainly concentrated to the larger cities. So people in the rural Sweden, they have a very long distance to these kind of schools. And because of that, it was mainly those of privileged social background could go to the schools because the parents could send them away, pay for their food and accommodation, whereas the poorer kids, they were needed on the farms, so they could not travel for education. So the social democrats said that one important thing we need to do is we need to build new schools. So similar to the idea of Jefferson, they had this idea that we need to locate these schools close to these people living in these more rural areas. And that's what they did, and especially during the 30s and 40s, they did. So what we see with this solid line here is the number of municipalities in Sweden with junior secondary schools. So looking at the early 20th centuries, there were 125 such municipalities. In 1945, there were 250. At the same time, on the other axis, we see what is the distance for individuals to the schools. Here in 1905, the average distance was about 20 kilometers. And then by the end of the 40s, that was down to just over 6 kilometers. So they introduced new schools, and as such, a result of that, they also decreased the distance that individuals had to travel to the schools. And what we ask in this study is, do we see an effect on that on their likelihood of becoming politicians? And more precisely, since for reasons of data requirements, we're going to look at cohorts born from 1921 to 1935. So we're going to sort of focus on this rather steep increase in the number of municipalities. And then we're going to compare those individuals that were just too old to enter these newly built schools to those that were born a little bit later. So the schools were actually there when they enter this age, when you usually enter this junior secondary schooling. And then we're going to sort of compare these individuals with a difference and different setup and see, do we see a higher likelihood of running for office or being elected to political office among those that were born late enough to be able to enter this newly established school? And doing that, we see these green bars. That is just the reform effect or the treatment effect, sort of by comparing this pre and post establishment of the school. And these are reform effect in percentage points. Need to remember here, the probability of being nominated in the sample is just about 3%. So it's just 3% of all individuals that ever sort of appear on a party list or elected to office. Elected to office then is even less. There is just 1 in 100. So that is the way it is with these kind of reforms. They're very rare outcomes. Most people do not do it. But what we see here is that if they open a new school, the chances of being nominated to political office increase by about 0.5 percentage points. So compare that with 3%, that is an increase about 20%. Looking at the election, that reform effect, the other green bar, is about 0.3 percentage points compared to an average of 1 percentage point. That's almost a 30% increase in the likelihood of being elected to office. And that is the sample as a whole. But we said that perhaps it could be the case that these kind of reforms are more important for certain children than others. The problem here, since these are born in the 1920s, we don't have data on the parents. So for this study, we could not do what we really wanted to do and see whether or not there was a difference across their parental social background. But what we have is we know in what parishes these individuals were growing up. And the parishes in Sweden are smaller than municipalities. So each municipality were divided in a number of smaller parishes. So we could then measure the typical occupations in these different parishes. And some of these parishes, because they had segregation in Sweden already then, they're going to have a larger fraction of working class parents, especially fathers working sort of in working class occupations, whereas other parishes going to have parents with non-working class or white collar backgrounds. So what we can do then is we can compare the reform effect across children who we know were grown up in these working class parishes and these non-working class parishes. And that's what we do comparing these red and blue bars. The red bars are the working class parishes, the blue bars are the non-working class parishes. And what we see then is that this bar is larger than that bar, and that bar is larger than that bar by a pretty large amount. That one is about 80% larger than that one. This one is almost 3 times as large as that one. So that's really saying that seems like this reform were benefiting people growing up in working class parishes more than individuals growing up in non-working class parishes. So here is the first evidence that one, the reform can affect political participation, but two, that the effect is perhaps more pronounced among individuals of low social background. Another study was of a reform that was undertaking in Sweden during the 1950s and early 60s. And we have similar reforms in many other countries in Europe at that time. Really, sort of, the main thing here was to sort of lengthen compulsory schooling. So in Sweden, compulsory schooling was lengthened from 7 years to 9 years. So it was 2 more years of schoolings for those that only attended primary schools. They also partly abolished this kind of two-track systems, or at least they delayed the tracking. Before that, people were tracked into sort of theoretical and vocational tracks at an earlier age. Now, people were sort of kept together in the same classroom for 9 years, and after that, one could choose secondary school. So there were 2 things happening during this reform. That is more of compulsory schooling, up from 7 years to 9 years, and that were obviously mainly affecting those that before that would have dropped out of school after primary school. They got more education as a result of this reform. If you were going on to universities, not much happened, except that you have to spend more time with people of a different social background than yourself. So that was one of the things that one also had in mind with this reform, was to sort of keeping individuals of social different background together in the same classroom for a longer time. The nice thing with this reform was that this was the time when the politician wanted to try out their ideas. So this was not implemented at the same time in all municipalities. Rather, they had this evaluation process, and the idea was to gradually implement this in different parts of Sweden, in different municipalities. There was about 1,000 municipalities at this time, in order to see whether or not this affected the different outcomes. And obviously, the top of the mind of the politician at this time was not voter turnout or whether or not they run for office. They would more be interested in see how effective sort of the probability to going on to. Now they tried to have this idea. So there was a sort of national agency trying. So it was not done by lottery. So there were differences in who went first. But they had this idea that they tried to pick municipalities of different size on different parts of the country and sort of with different situation in the labor market. But obviously they were not sort of random draws. You could always be that there were some different tracks here. But in the paper we try to see, and we don't see sort of any obvious differences in these pre-reform trends, which is usually what you're afraid of. So what we see here is sort of this is just sort of the gradual implementation. So this is the number of the share of individuals who go to this new school system, and the dashed line is the share of the overall municipality. So we see in the beginning here, they are still in the old school system. By the end, they have all transferred. But it does it gradually. And because of that, we can again use this kind of difference and different strategy, because we have these kind of natural experiments where people living in different municipalities, but being of the same age, they go to different school systems. And within a municipality, those just a few years older than others also go to different school systems, whether depending on when this new school system was implemented in these municipalities. So what we can do then is we can use this as a kind of natural experiment to do this difference and difference design. And we have then about 800,000 individuals. And what we do is then to look at the probability that they run for office as adults. And they have data here. This was our early articles. Here we just have data from 1990 to 2010. But we just look on, did they ever run for office during that time? And see, is there a difference depending on whether you went to this old school system with only 7 years of compulsory education, or if you went to this new school system with 9 years of compulsory education. And in order to summarize these findings in one slide, we see that, and now we could do what we couldn't do before. Now we can differentiate between individuals of working class background and non-working class background. So now we're just looking at the occupations of the parents, in this case mainly the fathers, because this was a time when a lot of women in Sweden were still housewives. So if only one partner had a job, it was most typically the male or the father of the children. So the first thing we do, we just look, is there an average effect? We don't find any average effect. So on average, it is not that individuals being subject to a new school system had a larger likelihood of running for political office. So if we just would stop there, then we would reach a similar conclusion as this education as a proxy view and saying, hey, education is perhaps not causally related to the likelihood of becoming a politician as an adult. But since we had this idea that it could differ across different kind of family backgrounds, and what we do here is we split that, and then we can kind of see why we do not see an average effect. Because in this case, it's not only the fact there is not a zero effect here, it's even a negative effect among those with non-working class parents, whereas there is a rather large positive effect among those with working class parents. This one is not really statistically significant in all specification, but really, the idea here is that among those of disadvantaged social background, we find a rather large positive effect, 0.3 percentage points, The average here is about 3%, so it's about a 10% increase in the likelihood of running for office. And then one might think it's a bit strange that we get this negative effect. Were they really hurt by this reform? One option is that they were hurt. There are some slight indication that, for instance, that some individuals had to spend more time with people of a different social background than themselves. And some people argue that might be negative for them. But I think a more sort of probable cause in this case is the way that we think about sort of standing on a party list. Because a party list often have a fixed number of spots. So to some extent, it's a zero-sum game. That is, if you have one group increasing the likelihood of being on the list, some people also need to leave the list. So I guess another way to think about this is that since this is sort of a rather special form of political participation, that is, if you drastically increase sort of the participation among one group, you're likely to decrease. In the same way, we can think what happens when we get more women on the ballots. Some of the men have them to give place for the women. So we can think about similar reforms that are positive for women, but they are negative for men. It could also be. I guess most of these are sort of, they are like hobby politicians. They don't earn any money. Most of these are at the local level. But that could also be. So what we see really then is that we see a positive effect for that group and a negative effect for that group. So the overall difference is about 0.5 percentage point. And that sort of gets us to the next thing. What happens then to the class differences in the likelihood of being nominated to political office? Then we can see pre-reform, the difference or this green bar is about 1.3 percentage points. After reform, then we just subtract this reform effect, about 0.5 percentage points, and then we are down here to about 0.6-0.7%. So really, the class difference then decreased by about 40% as a result of this reform. So that, to some extent, also support what we saw on the previous slide, that is this kind of reform of the educational system contributed to mitigating the impact of family background on political participation, here measured as being nominated to political office. The third study, the first one was looking at school openings during the 30s. The second one was to doing compulsory education reform in the 1950s. The latest reform we study is a reform of upper secondary education in Sweden, and especially then vocational education. They were undertaken in the early 1990s in Sweden. So in Sweden, we have the system that if you go into theoretical tracks at the secondary school, they were 3 years, and they prepared you for the university. If you were doing vocational education, going to be a builder or social worker or something, then these courses were only 2 years. But then the government had this idea that we should also make these 3 years. You're going to add more theoretical content, more civics, and we also sort of make it easier for people doing vocational education to proceed to universities. So that is the idea that we're going to extend vocational education by 1 year. We're going to put in more of social science and civics. Here also, before they implemented this reform, they had this idea about the pilot. So they had this pilot scheme running for 4 years, where they were trying this out in different municipalities. And what they then said that these municipalities, a certain share of your vocational places should be 2 years, and another share should be 3 years. So within a municipality, you can have some 2 year vocational education and some 3 years. And then you can have a different share across municipalities and across time. And that's what you see here in these graphs. They are showing sort of the rolling out of this pilot. Initially, there were almost no municipalities who had 3 year vocational educations. In the end, this is the distribution. So here you see you have some, about 20 municipalities where all vocational education were now 3 years rather than 2 years. And you have only about 50 of these 250 municipalities in which all vocational education was still of the two-year thing. So again, you kind of see sort of the pattern here. Now we have this variation across municipalities and across time. And then we can use this kind of difference and different strategy. And to answer that question again here, they're still not completely randomized. So you have this national agency picking these pilot municipalities. But if you look at the data, there is no clear evidence of any pre-reform trends. So if you look at those implementing this with a high reform intensity and compare those with a low reform intensity, they look very similar before the pilot was rolled out. So therefore, we argue that it should work to compare individuals being in these different school systems. And the idea was then to be, do we see an effect on their political participation? And now we looked at turnout rather than candidacy, because now we had turnout data and they were a bit younger. So now we're going to look at, did they increase the political turnout in elections in this group? And here we had data for 2010, so that's what we used. And now we also have some more variation in parental background. Previously we just had occupational data going back to the 1960s, but now we have more elaborate measures. So now we used three things. Now we use the education of the parents, the income of the parents, and the occupational status. We just construct an index, and then we get this distribution of parental background, and now we just split that into quartiles. So we have the lowest quartiles, they are those whose parents have the lowest education, income, and occupational status. The fourth quartile are those at the top of the parental background distribution, the highest earnings, the most prestigious jobs, and the longest education among the parents. And then we just see if we look at the impact of these vocational education reform, do we see an increase in turnout? If we do it for all individuals, we see a slight increase here, just above 0.5 percentage points. That is not statistically significant. So if you're just going by that, we will not say that this reform was very effective in increasing voter turnout in this group. Again, we might come to the conclusion that those saying that this relationship is mainly spurious, they might be correct. But since I have this idea that it could be different in different parts of the distribution, we simply see what happens if we split this parental background. So we have these four quartiles. So these are the individuals from the most disadvantaged social backgrounds, parents with less education, income, and occupational prestige than others. And here we see that turnout increased by about 3 percentage points. Whereas for the other three quartiles, we don't see anything. We see small negative effects, but they are very close to zero. So here is just that, and 3 percentage point, that is comparing a municipality where all vocational education are of the two-year type to a municipality where all vocational education are the 3 years type. So if you just switch from 2 to 3 years for all individuals, you would expect to an average increase voter turnout among the most disadvantaged by about 3 percentage points, nothing in other three quartiles. But as I said before, we had this idea whether or not this is due to the return or resource effect, because it's obviously also the case that before this reform, people down here, they were more likely to go to vocational schools, whereas people up here, they were more likely to go to the theoretical. So we should also expect that individuals in the bottom of the parental background distribution, they should be more affected by this reform. So their educational level should increase more as a result of reform. So is it that what drives the result? And in order to find that out, we do this kind of IV strategy. This is an IV language, is what you call the reduced form effect, but then we can also rescale this by sort of the additional take-up of education in different groups. And doing that, we get a graph like that, where these reddish bars, they are the increase in the probability of completing at least three years of secondary education. So if you complete 3 years of secondary education or more, then you score a 1 on this. Otherwise, you score a 0. And then we see in all groups, there is a positive effect. But that's biggest, as we should expect, in this lowest quartile. There, the probability of having at least 3 years of secondary education is increasing by about 25 percentage points as a result of the reform. Whereas here, the top quartile, that increase is just above 5 percentage points. And that's simply because these individuals do not, it's not as common for them pre-reform to attend vocational education. Most of these individuals, they tend to go to theoretical upper secondary school in Sweden. But really, these bluish bars, they are instead these kind of IV estimates. And that's simply saying that in this group, quartile one group, we see an increase in voter turnout that is about 12 percentage points. So now we rescale this 3% by the share that actually affected by this reform. And then we see that return effect in this group is very large, about 12 percentage points, whereas these blue bars are very close to zero for the other three groups. So here it appears that it's mainly this return effect driving these results. It really seems that education is more important for the turnout of individuals from disadvantaged social backgrounds. So trying to wrap this up, one can ask, what kind of lessons have we learned from these three studies? I think one important lesson is that the patterns appear, at least to me, rather similar. First of all, there are small or no average effects. At least we can say so for two of the three studies. In the first study, there is an average positive effect, but still we do not have the opportunity to do really what we do in the later studies. But on average, it doesn't suggest that increasing education has a large impact on political participation in the population as a whole. And again, that might lead us to believe that education is important. But what we have seen in all three studies is substantive positive effects among individuals of disadvantaged social backgrounds. So, very important message. Another question, obviously, always, how special is Sweden? I don't know. You tell me. But I think that if you find something like that in Sweden, which is rather equal, education could also work in other countries. But you should also remember that Sweden in the 1930s was not as equal as it was in the 1980s. Another thing, here we have studied the impact of family background in terms of sort of the class background of individuals. Yesterday I instead talked about how politically active the parents were. We have some ongoing work, we try to do something like that. Tentative results, they are similar. They're saying that this intergenerational correlation in political participation seems to decrease when you increase education. But I will come back and present those results at a later time. So, wrap up then is that I think on overall these studies actually support the idea that education can actually help mitigate the importance of family background in democratic politics. And that notwithstanding this criticism that we heard in recent years saying that education is just a great proxy rather than a great equalizer. And in particular, I think we have learned that education is especially important to prepare individuals from disadvantaged social backgrounds for the roles as citizen and potential political rulers in a country. So given all that, I would argue that wisely implemented educational reforms can have a role to play in the breaking of the vicious cycle of intergenerational political inequality, and thereby also enable democracy to actually fulfill that unfulfilled promise that I started with democracy had said that the idea of democracy should be that all individuals should have similar and equal political opportunities to participate and influence political decision. Perhaps education can help making that more likely in the future. On the other hand, we should not believe that the solution is as simple as that. If we just give individuals more education, all problems will go away. Probably not. But at least I think there is sufficient evidence to be a little bit hopeful that education can be one of those pieces that are needed if we would like to make our democracies a bit more equal in the future. Now, we haven't looked at that. At the time, we didn't have data on that. Some economists have looked at these reforms, and yeah, they have that sort of, there are one thing they find also sort of the probability of dropout increased as a result of reform. So they're also a bit, there are these downsides of this reform. That is, if you force people who are not really sort of motivated to go to school to stay for 3 years or in 2 years, it also increases the chances that they're going to drop out. So there are some sort of economic disadvantages with reform, but we don't see that in our data, but we haven't looked at the test scores or grades. Now, I guess the problem is to find this kind of exogenous variation in what subject they attend, because here you have this strong selection effect. We know those people that sort of attending a lot of social science, they tend to be more politically interested to begin with. So there are some, I have some colleagues that try to looking sort of university educations. They're trying to use these cutoffs. But so far, I don't think they buy you enough variation to really say something precise. So we don't have anything like that. I think there are some studies from the US where they try to sort of randomly assign more of civic studies in some schools. But the problem is there, often these studies are very small and they're rather imprecise. On average, they find some small effects, but they're not big enough to see whether or not it particularly matter for certain subgroups, because that would be my hunch, I guess, given my own priors and results. I would argue that it's especially certain individuals that you will make more politically active and interested by providing them with more civic education. Some people will. The problem is that sort of there are so few of these individuals being elected to the national level. So we don't have enough precision. What we have done is looking at sort of regional, and there you see something similar. But the regions often, they are also, you have pretty many. But so we tried initially to do something about sort of being sort of running for national parliament. But the problem is you just have 350 seats in the national parliament and not that many individuals being candidates. So once you try to compare these groups, just pre and post this, there are too few to buy you anything. So the problem is that we don't have enough precision. And that's, I guess, the main reason why we look at being nominated. Because even when you go to elected, there's such a rare outcome. So breaking the data down by these small cells, is they're going to be too few. Thank you very much.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.